Darkness. Absolute darkness. Light on the ground with my eyes closed, I wished from the bottom of my heart to remain in complete darkness. Darkness is in complete ignorance, oblivious to the abominations I witnessed. Of course, I cannot go back in time. I cannot erase my memory and forget the dark truth I have come to know. Do you wonder what it is? Here is my story.
Sir?
Sir?
I heard from afar, struggling to get away from the slumber's grip and get closer to the voice. I soon felt her hand press on my shoulder with as much respect and strength as possible until I woke up from my deep sleep. Sorry, I said, as soon as I opened my heavy eyes in complete confusion and dizziness.
We arrived.
The mature lady sitting next to me said with a smile.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, madam.
I quietly answered, shaking my head and rubbing my eyes with one hand. I have never slept so much in a flight, I remember telling myself in my thoughts, also wondering what could have knocked me out. As soon as I stepped out of the plane, the landscape welcomed me with open arms. I witnessed on the spot why tourism was one of the main strengths of that country. I felt so angry with myself for missing the view during the landing, but everything was still amazing, even on the ground. Imagine an airport next to one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. Here it is. Those were the first three words that came to my mind as I descended the plane's stairs. My escape. The only way out of the pain that invaded my heart since the loss of my best friend. My pal. My bro. Ronald Ronnie Finley. At least, that is what my 19-year-old self believed. Some time away in a foreign country, far from the city that bore all the memories of my friend and I. I quickly went through all the procedures before I reunited with my Uncle Simon and my two cousins, Wes and Stephanie.
Welcome, Jake,
they all shouted with smiles and open arms, attracting attention towards us and almost embarrassing me in the process.
Thanks, thank you,
I said, quietly with an awkward grin. We hugged, chatted briefly, and started walking towards the exit. And everything was already going just great, or so I thought, because I did not know that the first red flag waited for me outside. We exited the airport and started walking towards Uncle Simon's car, ready to go home. There was an old woman lying on the ground somewhere in the parking area, and not far from us. From the view of her stained clothes, I realized quickly that she was a homeless person having a rest. She heard us talk, and the noise attracted her attention and obviously her eyes. However, as soon as she saw me, she lifted her head up. Up until that moment, I did not give it that much attention, and the others did not even notice. But after a few seconds, she quickly stood up, froze, and her accusing eyes riveted on me.
"Don't look at her,"
Uncle Simon said, lowering his voice. We all noticed her at that point, and even stopped talking, hoping that she would not do something worse. Despite Uncle Simon's advice, I could not help myself to take a few glimpses of the old lady, her stare, and the hatred in her eyes. She seemed to scold me with her look, like I was doing something wrong and indecent, such as walking there with just my underwear.
"Is she all right? Like, what's up with the staring?"
Stephanie asked when we reached the car and started loading my stuff. Still under the piercing look of the old woman. She stood there, petrified, as the wind motioned her long and greasy gray hair.
"She must have a mental illness,"
Wes replied.
"Yeah, she might. That's why I asked you not to."
Uncle Simon stopped, scanning the whole area and where the old lady stood with her eyes. Soon, we all looked in that direction and did the exact same thing.
"Where is she?"
I asked, unable to see where she went. There was no way a lady of that age could move that fast and just disappear. But she was gone, vanishing into thin air.
I suggest we get out of here,
Wes quietly said.
Totally agree,
Uncle Simon supported. The ride home gave me another chance to contemplate the splendor of the city. Along the way, Uncle Simon, Wes, and Stephanie kept pointing at different places and attractions and telling me what they are all about and what we can do there. I came to have some fun for the holidays, but did not expect to have so many options. Every year in that city, there is a huge fair lasting several weeks that I intended to take full advantage of. My Uncle Simon got the idea and pretty much organized the whole trip. He always treated me so nice and never missed any opportunity to offer me anything. Therefore, despite being his younger sister's adoptive son, I never really felt that way. Uncle Simon largely contributed to making me a part of the family. Since he did not want me to be annoyed all the time by my two younger cousins and wanted me to have some privacy, he decided to accommodate me in one of his many homes. I still remember the amazement when we finally arrived, a whole house just for my 19-year-old self. At that moment, I thought about how a car and a cute and funny girl would just take an already perfect picture to an awesome level. Uncle Simon waved at a few people, and we made our way towards the entrance throughout the beautiful garden. I took a few glimpses at the surroundings and saw how it was a nice neighborhood with decent houses, looking just like the one I would be staying in. I had also seen a few people doing various things like lawn mowing, an old man walking a dog, people talking, children playing, a man sweeping the streets, and another one who came to talk to him. The house was well kept, and Uncle Simon, of course, ensured that I would not find myself lacking anything, from food to entertainments to cash.
"Just call me if you need anything,"
he said on the departure. I began unpacking, and the first thing I saw after opening my suitcase was a framed photo of Ronnie and I. My lips curved into a smile, and I remember how bubbly my best friend was. I mean, just from that picture, anyone could tell who was the funny one and who was the boring one. He had a small scar close to the eye, and, according to him, that made him look like some sort of bad boy that attracted girls, and feminine company is something Ronnie never lacked. He had a quite unique way to talk and pronounce certain expressions. For example, he would say, "How doing?" instead of "How you doing?" or saying, "Thank," instead of "Thanks," or "Cool meeting you," instead of "Nice to meet you." Quite a unique guy, I thought, as I shook my head and put the picture on the desk next to my bed. With some streaming and popcorn on my mind, I unpacked as fast as I could. During the night, when the binge-watching started to rather bore me, I began to doze off a little bit, slowly drifting to sleep. Around 2 in the morning, for the very first time, I heard that hissing sound. The sound of hell. The sound that will forever ice my veins in blood. It was accompanied by noises of leaves and bushes being shaken and sounds of fast steps on the grass. First, let me switch off any source of lights, I thought, to then take a careful look through an opening on the curtain. I did exactly that, and my heart almost exploded in my chest. Hidden in the shadows of the green fence, a pair of small, glowing, wide eyes stared right at me. They were so distant from each other that I convinced myself that those eyes could not fit on a human face, unless that human had an abnormally wide face and big head. Whatever the thing was, it was certainly massive. Stepping back almost immediately, I thought of logical actions I could take to solve the situation. But at the same time, the thing in the garden moved. I heard its fast steps on the grass and looked again through the curtain, only to see it move so fast along the fence, still covered by the shadows. From what I saw, it was moving on all fours with the speed and behavior of a cockroach. run, stop again and again. But honestly, I could not recall of any animal of such size moving so fast and in that strange of a manner. I ran to my phone to call the cops right away. The sounds of hissing and steps resonated all around the house, making me realize that the thing had a crazy speed, until a horrifying and more plausible theory blossomed in my mind. What if there were several of them? After dialing the number and launching the call, all I could hear was interference and static noises, until the hissing sound also arose from the phone. I threw my phone on the ground in fear, and sped to the kitchen to retrieve 3 knives, still escorted by all the nightmarish noises. Between the kitchen door and the one of the many pieces of furniture in the living room, there was a space wide enough for me to hide. I curled up there, holding one of the knives between my hands, trembling more and more, each time I glimpsed the fast shadow at the window, and jumping each time it hissed. I stayed there, enduring such a nightmare for hours until it suddenly stopped exactly at 4 o'clock. A heavy silence almost hurt my ears, only pierced by the sounds of the ticking clock and my rapid breathing. What to do next? I had neither the strength nor the brains to think of anything logical to do at the moment. I just stayed there, and that little hiding place is where morning found me. Of course, there was all the rest. The police, the little investigation that led to nothing, and Uncle Simon, who decided to install a sophisticated security system. But at least, with the arrival of the police the next day, some of my neighbors were curious, so they came to inquire about the whole incident, people with whom I became good friends with afterwards. Among them, Stanley, his daughter, Lily, and Mr. Howard, who lives in the opposite house to mine on the street, with his faithful dog, Mac. Stan was a 35-year-old man at that time, a cool, fun, and talkative guy, and was the only one who talked to the sweeping man, according to him. Stan told me that his name was Eric, and I did not think much of him since I only saw him a few times, like on the day of my arrival, sweeping the streets with his face hidden under his baseball cap. The strange thing about Stanley was that he likes to engage in the same topics of conversation repeatedly, making the same jokes. His daughter, Lily, was very cute and was 17 years old at the time. We made it a habit of her always knocking 3 times and saying, "Lily time," once at the door each morning so that I could give her some cookies. She chose the "Lily time" phrase all by herself. Mr. Howard always walked his dog, Mac, each morning, also exercising a little bit on the same occasion. It became a little routine to see Lily in the morning, then to wave at Mr. Howard through the window, and have Stan visiting later in the afternoon. The animal and hissing sound incident did not happen again. Therefore, I began to feel very comfortable in the house. Life was getting better, even very great. I found a spot from where I liked to order food, and another one where I could just sit and relax. I even visited my Uncle Simon a few times. His main house, of course, was far better than the one I was staying in. It also gave me the opportunity to eat quality food from my uncle's wife, Evelyn, and spend some time with my cousins. Following a few weeks, the long-awaited first day of the fair finally arrived. Wes, Stephanie, and I decided to go on this very day, even though we knew it would be crowded. While my cousins just drove into that paradise just as if it were their second home, I felt like a little boy brought into an imaginary world of fantasy and magic. One of the first thoughts that hit my mind was if I could spend the night in that world. My cousins kept on dragging me by the hand so that I would not lose track of them. For the first 30 minutes in the fair, my head stayed up as I looked left and right, often also spinning on myself with a bright smile, entranced by the dance and symphony of the place. The shops with their shiny products calling for my eyes, the food stands caressing my nose with delicious and aromatic scents, the clowns, the balloons, and, of course, the games. Don't get me wrong. I've been to fairs in my own town, But of course, none of them could compare with that one, as if everything in that city was magical and better than anywhere else. After about 5 PM, we roamed some minutes more in the fair, feeling tired with our stomachs full of hamburgers. We engaged in an area we have already been to before, and it did not take us long to notice something we did not see earlier, or even expect to discover. Discreetly placed between a soccer shop and a shooting target game stand, as if too shy and avoided being seen or too small compared to its two neighbors, a little brown tent with a somber entrance attracted me and my cousins.
"Are you guys thinking what I'm thinking?"
Stephanie asked, with a hint of excitement in her voice.
"Hell yeah,"
Wes replied. Embellished by the coat of sunset, a visible sign glinted, indicating what we were bargaining for. "Maribel, the steer," we could read on the shiny sign. I entered first and was immediately seen by a smiling and charming blonde lady, welcoming us with a casual "hey," before gesturing us to sit in front of her table. The premises completely contrasted with our expectations, since there were no candles, skulls, strange books, or weird bracelets or objects. I also laughed when I saw my cousins wearing a mask of utter disappointment. "So, how does it work?" I questioned, hoping not to look stupid in front of the beautiful lady. Fortunately, she was cool, and after a few explanations, the seance began in no time. I placed my right hand into hers before she closed her eyes, all of us unaware about the outcome. It did not even last 10 seconds. Almost immediately, I saw her gradually frown, and she began hyperventilating while squeezing my hand. In complete confusion, I looked at my cousins, who looked back at me, while Maribel started screaming and still holding my hand, and struggling as if she wanted to release me, but could not. Soon after, as her eyes stayed closed, huge and dark circles appeared around them before she let out one last eerie scream and finally released my hand and crawled backwards in absolute fear. We looked at her looking at us while the dark circles slowly disappeared, completely defeated by the situation, not knowing what to do or what to say. A few seconds later, with a soft and trembling voice, she let out a simple and clear instruction that was still incomprehensible for us.
"Get out,"
she quietly said, not triggering any response from us.
"Get out! Get out!"
she then shouted repeatedly, making a reach for her phone. Understanding that she planned on calling the cops on us, we booked out of the tent, with the intention of exiting the fair once and for all. I prayed for all of us not to be stopped by any security guards. We reached the exit and sat somewhere near the street, catching our breath. We could still not say anything about the occurrence, and just looked at each other, still terrified by those eyes, those dark circles within them. 9 minutes later, still shocked and silent, we waited for a requested ride home and hoped to put traumatic events behind us. Later that night, I lay on my bed looking for a better position to rapidly fall asleep to, rolling left and right, lying in turn on my back and stomach respectfully. I did not care about the loud creaking noises the mattress made until I noticed another creaking sound right above me. The sound of something heavy enough to make a ceiling creak. I slowly looked at the ceiling, only to see the familiar white paint and nothing else. I stayed in that position for at least 20 seconds, starting to think that creaking sound came from the bed only. When I turned to my right, I heard it again, that time more clearly. Every trace of fatigue left me as I decided to investigate what on earth could be hiding right above my head. I put one foot on the ground and heard the noise again, stopping me in my tracks. That time, I froze longer, and nothing happened as long as I stayed immobile. The moment I moved to put my other foot on the ground, the noise started again, and I realized that Something was in the ceiling, apparently imitating my every move. Eyes closed, already submerged by sheer fear. I took slow steps backward in the direction of the door, only to hear similar cautious steps resonating in the ceiling and in the same direction. I stopped once again and opened my eyes. I looked at the ceiling, gathering the courage I needed to do something I didn't know I would instantly regret. Not sure about the reply I would get, if any. I passed my hands through my hair, eyes fixed on the ceiling before I spoke the words. "Is there anyone?" I stopped in my tracks, silenced by the immediate reply as the intruder said the exact same words at the exact same time. "Is there anyone?" A demonic and distorted voice resounded from the ceiling, accompanied in its speech by a hissing sound. The thing was back. Terror carried me outside of the bedroom in a flash. My only objective was the entrance door. At each stride towards my salvation, I could hear a sound above my head at the exact same time, as if it were synchronized. Only a few meters away from the locked door, I thought. The moment I saw the entrance, the thing headed in the same direction with the exact same pace as mine. I intended to burst it open with my shoulder, just like in the movies, and not sure if I was strong enough to do it. At least, in my mind, with a strong press on the door, the alarm system may alert the neighbors and the armed response unit. Now or never, I thought, as I threw myself forward, shoulder first, before I was stopped on the spot by the strongest grip I have felt on my neck. Whatever that was, it was powerful. It then proceeded to knock my head on the wall, again and again, as I let out screams in complete despair. "It's over," I thought. I was about to join Ronnie in the afterlife. The thing did not stop until I was about to faint. I still remember being dropped on the floor, then dragged by the foot, with my vision blurred and unable to see anything until I passed out. "Lily, delivery on the way," I replied, as I always did, still feeling dizzy. I put a foot on the ground, and the events of the night before flooded back into my mind. Was I dead? I asked myself. Certainly not if Lily is knocking on the door. So, what happened after I fainted? I rushed to the bathroom to look at myself in the mirror. I was thoughtless. Not a single bruise or any trace of brutality anywhere on my skin. Was it all just a nightmare? I gave Lily her cookies and saw her off. Following some reflection on the event, I decided not to call the authorities. There was no sign of intrusion, no sign of brutality, nothing to testify about that horrible occurrence. I went from the living room to the entrance door and stood on my porch for no apparent reason. Nothing out of the ordinary, as expected. Lily played with some friends, a neighbor watering some plants in her garden, and the sweeping man conversing with Stanley. Carried by the need to talk to someone, I walked in the direction, also willing to finally meet Eric, the sweeping man. I greeted a few people along the way as I approached the duo. Stanley spotted me from a certain distance, smiled, and notified Eric that I was getting close. I smiled back at Stanley, quite forcefully, and awkwardly because I still had so much on my mind.
"Hello, Jake,"
Stanley said when I was close to them. Eric turned to me and removed his baseball cap that was always hiding his face and smiled at me as well before saying in a very familiar voice,
"Hi, Jake, right? Cool to meet you. I'm Eric," he said, stretching out his arm towards me in a greeting gesture.
I froze before them and considered at that very moment that I was indeed in a really terrifying and messed up nightmare.
"How you doing?"
Eric added, ignoring my awkward reaction.
"Is everything all right, Jake?"
Stanley questioned, both smiling at me, probably trying to stay sympathetic, but honestly ended up fueling the creepiness of the situation. My reaction, on the other hand, was not awkward to myself, but rather logical, because the man standing in front of me at that moment was Ronnie. My best friend, Ronnie. Same voice, same expression, same face, and even the same scar at the same place on his face. I did not let out a single word. I turned around, and under the look of my neighbors, I ran back to the house as if my life were at stake. I locked myself in the house, trembling in fear, without any option to consider in my mind. I was lost. Several days later, I still did not dare lay one foot outside of the house. Fortunately for me, the thing with the hissing sounds did not return. I only talked to my family on the phone, and stopped answering to Lily or Stanley knocking on the door. I made up some story to my uncle, and had him book a flight for my return to my hometown. I did not want to stick around and end up involving my uncle and my cousins in the newly found craziness of my life. First a creepy old lady, then a crazy seer, then creepy hissing creatures, and now Ronnie. Was it his ghost? That was it for me. In the meantime, I spent sleepless nights watching Ronnie through a window as he arrived in and left the neighborhood every single day, always for the same purpose of sweeping the street, as if to fuel more paranoia and fear in my mind. At his arrival and on his departure, Ronnie always stopped in front of my house, waving at me and smiling maliciously, since he somehow always knew that I was watching. He knew. Ronnie was aware that I knew he was not Eric. But how was that possible? How was he alive? And why all the lies? The scare routine continued for at least 3 days, and the day of my return flight grew near while my feelings and my views on the matter started changing. Whatever was going on, it was once again about my friend, and I had to do something, or at least try. Therefore, one evening, after he gave me the usual creepy goodbye, I watched him walk home before I stepped out of the house and started tailing him. We walked for a very long time. The heaviness in the air seemed to attempt to break my will, even though I could not stop my legs. I found myself following, like a robot or like a sheep slowly led to the slaughterhouse. I did not know if Ronnie was aware of my little spying adventure, as he walked looking straight ahead of him, not looking behind once, or even left or right. The more I followed, the darker the surroundings became. An eerie sense of dread arose in my mind, accompanied by the befitting sound of a strong, howling wind. Ronnie led me to the outskirts of the city. I hid, crouched behind an old car, and watched him join a mysterious man dressed in a dirty security guard outfit, waiting for him in front of an abandoned building. I didn't even have the time to wonder about the conversation topic when I heard a clicking sound behind me and felt something cold land on my neck.
End of the road, freak,
a deep male voice said behind me.
What? What are you doing?
I asked, afraid and confused at that point, not knowing what to do.
What am I doing?
The man replied and chuckled.
You're a freaking monster, and that's not supposed to be here. And you're asking what I'm doing? Don't worry, I'm here to send you back home, since you're so lost.
He added, pressing the cannon of his gun more heavily on my neck.
Please, please, I don't... Please, let me stay alive. I don't know what you're talking about. Please,
I said, going on a desperate plea just to survive.
Let you stay alive. Alive? Please,
the man said.
Turn around, slowly,
he ordered. I obeyed, sitting on the ground, shaking more heavily when I saw the barrel of the large shotgun just inches away from my head, and his face, especially his eyes, scanning my soul as he revisited his verdict.
No way,
he said, quietly, slowly lowering his gun.
Maribel. Oh, Maribel. She made a mistake,
he said, chuckling again and shaking his head.
Maribel, the seer?
I asked, still on the ground.
Well, she still has a gift for lasting impressions. I can see that,
he replied, helping me up.
You're not one of them, for sure. They know they're dead, so they never beg to stay alive. I almost...
He stopped, looking behind me. The vision of Ronnie talking to his mysterious acquaintance returns to my mind. I also looked in the same direction, only to realize that both had vanished. I then felt the man gripping me by the arm and rushed me in the opposite direction.
We gotta move, fast,
he said, as he started running. I imitated him, unaware of what was unfolding. Soon we heard movements and noises coming from the roofs of the buildings surrounding us. A few seconds later, the noises were accompanied by those frightening and monstrous hissing sounds. We ran faster. I saw him loading his gun, preparing for a survival fight. I could glimpse the shadows of our pursuers jumping above us from roof to roof like skillful ninjas. The man stopped next to a black van, tapped on it, indicating me to get in, while he stayed in cover, shooting at some of the creatures to facilitate our escape. I can still hear the deep growling of some of those things as they got hit. He soon entered the car and started the engine.
Thanks for at least starting the engine. That was very helpful, he said,
maneuvering swiftly and smoothly. He drove off towards our salvation, the hissing sounds lowering in intensity as we distanced our pursuers. I looked behind to see many of those things, jumping from roofs to the ground and watching us flee. Among them, I recognized the man in the security guard outfit, the old lady, and Ronnie, waving me goodbye once again, as he used to do. During the ride, the man asked me what I was doing there, spying on those demonic beings, and I explained everything, from the apparent death of Ronnie to that very moment. Just like myself, the man was not from that city. He introduced himself as Greg, and confirmed being contacted by Maribel to terminate me. And from that point, he proceeded to tell me what I needed to know about the strange beings.
First of all, Ronnie's dead. And that Eric freak you saw is not him at all. They're not human beings. Maribel and I call them soulless. They're lower-ranked demons that take on the appearance of the dead and use it in countries far away from the deceased origin land. For both obvious and also unknown reasons, the freaks are advised never to return to their homeland. It's also a tricky situation because they can remember a lot of things concerning the deceased, except the homeland. Most of them are always found having low-paid jobs or just living in poverty, surely to lay low, Greg explained.
The soulless. I see. But how and when did you guys know about these things? I questioned.
I don't know how Maribel did. She's gifted, you know. But as far as me, I've been hunting them since one of those freaks took the life of my brother, Brian. Him, some of my friends and I went on a bar one night in our hometown. He met a charming girl at a bar, talking to her until he ended up in a motel. When he woke up, he was laying on a grave in a cemetery far away in South America and lost his sanity. Then ultimately, his life after gave about strange health complications. That's why I'll never stop until I find that girl.
Are you sure about that? From what I saw, there's a lot of them.
I don't care. See this gun? Its bullets are equipped with super-salted concoctions from Maribel. That liquid's nothing for us, but poison for them. As long as I have it, I can manage. Look, I'm pretty sure you know that you can't go back to that house. Those freaks know where you live. Let's go to my hideout for now. Tomorrow night we'll meet Maribel somewhere. Then you'll decide what to do.
At the hideouts, I learned more useful things about the creatures and their strange behavior. As Greg put it, most of them are sets like clocks, robots, or computer programs. A lot of papers and piles of documents occupied most of the space in the small, messy apartment. Greg always managed to move around with all his information about the Soulless wherever he had to go. I managed to learn as much as I could during that night, until the accumulated fatigue of that crazy day knocked me out for at least 6 hours. The next evening, after he armed me with a few bottles full of the mysterious concoction, we departed for the hideout to a destination not far from the fair. With all those strange events, everything in the city appeared so dull and so fake to me. You know, I had the kind of feeling you have when there is an immediate threat in your life, preventing you from appreciating the beauty of any moments or anything. How can you go about your life when anyone around you may be a demon straight from hell? I'd seen the darkness of the world, and that darkness took away any shred of light inside of me.
Christ, Greg said, then took a sudden turn to the right, engaging in an alley before he stopped. Where is she?
He questioned.
Who? What's going on?
I asked. Greg accelerated and was progressing in the alley while he kept looking frantically all about to spot the mysterious person he was talking about, with me initially thinking he referred to Maribel. We finally arrived in a playground area where I could see a stunning lady seated in one of the swings. Greg parked the car, grabbed his shotgun, and ran to the lady. I instinctively followed, with one bottle in hand, still baffled by the occurrence, until we faced the girl.
End of the road, freak. It's time to pay for what you did to Brian,
Greg said, aiming at her.
End of the road, is it?
The lady said, smiling and standing.
For you, freaks.
As soon as she finished her statement, we saw many soulless people surrounding the playground. We neither saw nor heard them arriving and ended up trapped with no chance of escape. The one with the security guard outfits approached the lady with a bag in his hand.
Just as promised, Coraline, he said,
throwing the bag at the lady, then turning to face us.
I know you keep your promises, Roland,
she said, opening the bag to retrieve a severed human forearm, still bloody. She started hissing like a snake, and her face splits into two, revealing a large mouth with a massive reptilian tongue and sharp teeth, before she devoured the limb vigorously.
Oh, Christ,
Greg said, taking advantage of her voracious appetite to shoot at her. The bullet exploded in her belly and released the heavily salted concoction which started to burn her inside out. Coraline's death enraged Roland and all the other soulless as they all transformed. I remember thinking at that very moment that we had reached the end of the road. They attacked, the sight of them making those crazy jumps towards us with their wide-open mouths and wide glowing eyes will never leave my mind. But fortunately, I had Greg. His strategy consisted of protecting me by shooting at the creatures while I did my best to cover his back by splashing the concoction on any soulless I considered too close to us. I heard their deafening hisses turn to a gruesome growling at each impact. We fought like lions for hours, surviving the attacks and different strategies those monsters tried to devour us. Until...
Craig!
A voice called, and the remaining soulless stepped back, revealing a young man, accompanied by Ronnie, walking towards us.
Brian?
Greg said, visibly shaken by the surprise.
What? How?
Greg added.
Why are you doing this, man? Why are you rejecting the gift?
Brian asked his brother.
Yes, Jake. Why are you fighting something that is meant to save you? Why do you still cling to your boring, monotonous life?
Ronnie asked me.
What? Ronnie, what are you talking about?
I asked back.
Be careful, Jake. Remember, they're not the people we knew,
Greg warned.
You don't know. You mean, you don't remember?
Jake, buddy,
you killed me, Ronnie said. I felt like melting on the ground when I heard that. You offered me the gift of the afterlife, and now I'm alive again. More alive than before. You don't have to resist. Just come. Come and be reborn. More alive. Powerful. Limitless.
Brian said, gesturing to Greg as I approached him. Suddenly, Greg screamed. I turned to him and saw a soulless biting him deep in the flesh.
Run. Get out of here.
He managed to say, growling, enduring the tremendous pain. He threw the shotgun at me, but I could not operate it as it was too heavy for my untrained arms. I dropped it and took the last bottle I had and sped towards the van, waving the recipe like crazy to kill as many soulless as I could to escape. I didn't even make it out of the playground when I heard a loud explosion behind me that made me fly and land a few meters away from the van. I still had the bottle in my hand, and miraculously, there was still some of the liquid inside. I got up, entered the vehicle, and made my escape, driving like a crazy man, under the look of surprised and curious people who came to investigate the explosion.
No. No. That couldn't be possible, I thought. Ronnie died in a car crash, and I'm not a murderer.
I decided to leave on that day. No more waiting. I was sure my uncle could arrange that for me, but to avoid suspicion, I had to look normal and meet him with my luggage, as well as another well-cooked story. It may sound dumb on my part, but for me at the moment, I was so messed up that it was logical to me. Dawn greeted me when I still had hours on the road before I arrived at the house. The warmth of the sun and that light chasing away all the darkness of the previous night felt like a prophecy to me. A way of showing me, or clearly telling me, that I could still survive. I could still make it alive and go back home in one piece. Hours later, finally at my destination, I parked the vehicle, left the engine running, and armed with the bottle just in case, I sped inside the house to grab the last I could and leave. While I was almost trashing the bedroom, trying to prepare for my express departure, something very familiar occurred. I know it was something that I used to do every day, but at that time, I felt like reliving a scene I had already been through in the past.
Lily time,
the girl said, after three knocks on the door. Lily, delivery on the way, I replied, unwillingly and automatically, like a robot. It rang in my mind. Most of them are set like clocks, robots or computer programs. Was it sheer paranoia? Was I really one of those demons? How could I be one of them and not know it? No, it was getting worse and out of hand. Proving my paranoia-inflicted self wrong was an easy task. The bottle was right there on the desk near the bed. Confident about the outcome of this test, I took the bottle, opened it, and carefully let one drop of it fall on my left forearm. It burned. I let out a painful scream and dropped the recipe, wasting the rest of the precious concoction on the ground. This could not be it. I was soulless. Everything became clear. The old lady at the airport, Maribel's reaction after taking my hand during the seance. They both knew. Was it true? Did I really kill Ronnie? Was I really Jake Nilsson? Through the pain, an avalanche of thoughts invaded my mind, soon interrupted by three more knocks on the door.
Lily time,
the girl said again. What about her? What about Stanley, who always visited in the afternoon? I went to the kitchen and looked at the clock, then through the window, only to witness my neighbors doing something I had never noticed before. They were doing the exact same activities at the exact same time on the clock, just like in the previous days. Mr. Howard waved at me while he saw me just as usual. All those past days, I was so focused on watching Ronnie that I did not notice the pattern. Suddenly, as if they knew that I knew, they all stopped simultaneously and looked right at me. I jumped backwards in fear. I was surrounded with them once more.
Open the door, Jake. Or should I say James?
Lily said, with a demonic voice mixed with the hissing sound, before she started pounding on the door. They all surrounded the house, and I could hear others pounding on the other doors as they tried to find their way in, and I was now deprived of any effective weapon to fight them. Lily broke the door and entered, accompanied by her friends, all of them already in their monstrous form, ready to turn me into a meal for Lily.
"Welcome home, James,"
they all said at the same time. I turned to run away from them, only to see Stanley and many others invading the living room.
"Yes, James, welcome home. You're asking yourself so many questions right now. You're not supposed to be here. Why do you think you don't remember being one of us or what you did? Why do you think you slept so heavily on the plane?" Stanley asked. I stormed through the window, not caring about getting hurt, and landed on the grass, only to find myself surrounded by the old lady, Ronald, Ronnie, Brian, and many more. They all transformed, ready to devour me. Maybe as a well-deserved punishment for returning to my homeland. I closed my eyes, waiting for the first bite, when suddenly, their hissing was pierced by sounds of police sirens. 4 police sirens were dispatched to the address after several witnesses testified about seeing Greg's van leaving the location of the explosion. A few seconds after the police, the armed response arrived at the house, notified by the security system. The soulless returned to human form and remained immobile, smiling viciously at me. The officers had to push through them to arrest me. They stayed still, watching me being taken away by some of the officers, and still smiling, creeping out even the policemen. On my own demand, I remained in police custody until I was completely cleared of any suspicion. The police found my fingerprints matching at 99% with those of a man named James Delfitt in their database, born in 1924 and deceased in 1997, without any way to explain it. Once released, I went to the cemetery and saw my own real and original grave. James Delfitt. On the way to the exits, I saw the soulless version of Greg, now working as the keeper of the cemetery, smiling just like the others when they almost slaughtered me. I did not return to what I thought was my homeland, but I did not return to the people I thought were my family. If I am really soulless, chances are that I really killed Ronnie, and many others without any single memory of it. I can see them watching me, tracking me down relentlessly, like a notorious criminal on which an international arrest warrant was placed. Now you know. The darkness, what is out there, what surrounds you. However, I always wondered if I am the only one in this situation. People just like you, going about their daily lives, and many just like you have a daily routine. What proof do you have of really being Robert, Mary, John, Jennifer, Patricia, David, or Michael? What proof do you have of really being human? As for me, I know for sure that I never made any hissing sounds or even split my face into 2. So it means that I am real, don't you think? I am truly a human being, right?